Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ryan, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Navigator for pre-application call number 4. All lines have been placed on mute in order to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question at that time, simply press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Gian Johnson. You may begin.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for today's pre-application call for the Navigator FOA. I know some of you have joined us in the past and some of you are new, so I'm just going to go over some important dates and then highlights of the FOA, and then we have a couple frequently asked questions that we've been getting that we want to address with everybody so everyone can hear the answers, and then we're going to open the line up for questions for the rest of the time. So in terms of important dates, the first date is May 1st, which is tomorrow, and this is when the optional letter of intent is due. These are not required, but they do help us get a sense of where we might be receiving applications from and kind of the workload on our end. More important deadline is June 7th. That's when applications are due, and this is a hard 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time deadline. All applications must be submitted through grants.gov, and there's information on how to do that and the registration processes that need to take place ahead of time, all in the FOA, so please refer to that if you have questions on that process. We anticipate making award announcements August 15th. And then to briefly go over the FOA, this is a cooperative agreement, which is very similar to a grant, except it involves substantial HHS programmatic involvement with the recipient. And this basically means that HHS is going to work more closely with the recipients to support and stimulate their activities and more working jointly in a collaborative partnership type of relationship. This is a 12-month award. All work plans and timelines should reflect a 12-month work period. We have a total of $54 million available, and this is apportioned out to all states that are either going to have a federally facilitated or state partnership marketplace. So all the states that are able to apply are listed on page 9 and 10 of the FOA, but states that will have a state-based exchange or marketplace are not eligible to apply under this award, as those states will be awarding their own Navigator grants. So there's at least 600,000 available in each of the states listed in the FOA, and this pot of money is based on the number of uninsured and the population within the states. There's some information in the FOA about how exactly this funding methodology was worked through, if you're curious. It's at the bottom of the table on page 10. So in terms of eligibility, this FOA is open to self-employed individuals, private and public entities. You can apply as a single individual or entity, or you can join together with other groups in your area and form a consortium. The groups that are ineligible to apply for this award are health insurance issuers, subsidiaries of health insurance issuers, associations that include members of or lobby on behalf of the insurance industry, or recipients of any direct or indirect consideration from any health insurance issuer in connection with the enrollment of any individuals or employees in a qualified health plan or non-qualified health plan. The total number of awards per state is going to depend on a couple factors. The first is the regulatory requirement that there be at least two types of entities in each state or service area. And one of those must be a community and or consumer-focused nonprofit. And in addition to that, the awards on top of the required two will be based on the budgets and scope of the population that applicants are proposing to serve. In terms of activities required of grantees, there are 5 duties that all navigators must perform, and these can be found both in the exchange final rule as well as on page 6 of the FOA. applicants, when crafting their applications, they can propose to serve consumers in a small population or as large as they desire. However, they do need to keep in mind that irrespective of the population that you propose to serve, you should be prepared and able to assist anyone that comes into your office looking for assistance. There will be some reporting requirements associated with this grant. They're detailed as well in the FOA, and more information will also be provided in the final award packages that go out to grantees. Lastly, we have a couple of resources available on our website, which is cciio.cms.gov. There's an in-person assistance link along the left side of the screen, and you can click on that, and there's a handful of FAQs. There's a link to the FOA on grants.gov, and there's also some tips and instructions for applying for a federal grant. In case this process might be new to you, we've tried to create kind of a helpful tip sheet to walk folks through it. So before I open the line up for questions, a couple questions that I want to go over that we've been receiving in our inbox, and so I want to kind of get these answers out to everyone. The first is in terms of a consortium. I mentioned that you could group together with other entities in your area to serve a certain set of consumers. So the question that we've gotten a lot is, if a consortium applying for a Navigator Cooperative Agreement includes multiple types of entities, including one that's a community or consumer-focused nonprofit and another that's a different type, can the consortium apply for all of the funding available in a given state, since the applicant would meet the threshold of having at least two types of entities serving as a navigator in the state? And the answer to this is no, because this scenario would not meet the regulatory requirement that at least two types of entities, one of which must be a consumer or community-focused nonprofit, receive a cooperative agreement in the state. When looking at consortium applications, a consortium will only count as one entity, and only the lead applicant of the consortium applying for the funds will be looked at to determine the entity's type. So whatever type of entity the lead applicant is, that's the entity type that will be looked at for the entire group. The next question is, can a consortium with multiple entities divide the duties of a navigator so that one entity or group is performing some of the duties and another group is performing other duties? So generally the answer is no. All entities serving in a consortium are required to perform all the duties of a navigator. This includes members of a consortium proposing to serve in administrative capacity, such as like a lead applicant that only wants to do administrative work. This requirement may take different forms, however. For example, while the lead agency applying for navigator funds and all of the members of the consortium are required to perform all of the duties detailed on page 6 of the FOA, we also recognize that various organizations within a consortium may have particular expertise in one area, such as outreach and education. While organizations have to perform all the duties associated with the cooperative agreement, there is no requirement that each consortium member perform each of the duties for an equal percentage of time. Additionally, all staff associated with the Navigator Cooperative Agreement must be trained on all the duties of a navigator and be equipped to assist consumers through outreach and education and during the eligibility and enrollment processes. The last question is whether an organization meets the definition of a health insurance issuer. This has come up a lot with groups that sell Medicaid or Medicare plans and whether or not they're eligible to be a navigator. So when looking at whether you're eligible, we say that if you or your corporate affiliate are required to be a licensed agent or to be licensed to engage in the business of insurance in a state and are subject to state law that regulates insurance, you might be a health insurance issuer or have a relationship with a health insurance issuer that would make you ineligible for a navigator grant. We ask that you evaluate your specific corporate structures on a case by. We will evaluate your specific corporate structures on a case by case basis. The FOA requires that you submit a brief statement attesting that you are not an ineligible entity. So we ask that you keep this guidance in mind when drafting that statement. For example, by disclosing any corporate relationships with an entity that is required to be licensed to engage in the business of insurance in a state, and that is subject to state law that regulates insurance. So I know that was a lot of information and questions, but at this time, operator, if you could open the phone lines, we can begin to answer questions from those listening in.
At this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question over the phone, please press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Suzanne Fonfa. Your line is open.
Hello. I tried to ask questions the other day, and I was cut off, and I was told to send them in by email. And I'm wondering if you could please tell me or tell all of us where we would go to find answers to questions that people are asking.
Well, so if you have a specific question, we're happy to answer them now since you have the opportunity on the phone line. We have in the FOA, there is listed contact information for reaching out in terms of questions regarding the FOA, and that's listed in the document on grants.gov.
Okay.
That email address is...
Okay, so there's not going to be one place on your website where you're going to have answers to questions that everybody asks.
Well, we hope to have that right now. We're putting. There are some FAQs that are listed. Gian mentioned earlier. It's on CCIIO.cms.gov. And so there's some initial FAQs and other documents there, but we hope to include more.
Okay, well, let me ask my real questions then. My first question is, I was on the call yesterday for the State Marketplace Navigator Program in Illinois, and I'm a little bit confused about the different grants that are going to be out there for navigators, federal and state. Could you just talk a little bit about how those will interact?
Sure, I'm happy to. So the call that you're referring to is not something that CMS led, so I can't speak to anything that they may have said on that particular call, but I can give you an indication of where I think your questions may be coming from. So
okay.
Illinois and a handful of other states are what is referred to as a partnership marketplace,
mm-hmm.
and in particular, a consumer partnership marketplace. And in that, in consumer partnership marketplaces, there will be navigators, and those navigators will be chosen and selected through this application process, through this FOA. And there will also be something called, it's referred to in a few different ways, but generally speaking, I think it's referred to most frequently as in-person assistance. States who have a consumer partnership marketplace will be running their own in-person assistance program. And so if you're in Illinois, you were interested in performing the in-person assistance program that Illinois has put together, you would need to respond to any RFP or information that the state themselves put out.
Okay, and the functions will be similar but not identical, I would assume.
That's probably the case. I can't speak exactly to what Illinois is planning to put out in their proposal.
Okay.
But generally speaking, you're correct.
Okay, but it is two separate processes and two separate grants.
Yes,
okay.
And right.
Okay, my other question is, I know that from the other call and from what you've said today that proposals can be either a large geographic area, small geographic area, different populations, but I'm wondering whether your preference is fewer larger grants and whether or not therefore you would actually carve out a piece of a larger grant for a smaller applicant. In other words, if somebody said, I want to serve the entire state of Illinois except for the Chicago area, and then a smaller organization came along and said, we want to serve Champaign County, would you in fact carve out Champaign County for the smaller organization.
So our only requirement is that there be at least two types of entities within a state, and other than that, we have no preference in terms of size or for population served.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Randy Lohmaker. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. So I know you said there's some information on how you figured the funding. I've got sort of a specific question. I note that in Arizona, there's just under 1 million uninsured, and the funding allocation is about 1.6 million. So this is around $1.60 per uninsured person in Arizona to deliver this program. And that strikes me as just almost hard to understand, I guess. Can you give some color to that?
We did not put a per-person figure in the calculation for how much is allocated per state. We used the PUMA or the PUMS data that I think is referenced underneath that chart. And, you know, we have the amount of funding available that we've indicated, $54 million, and we allocated it based on a minimum of $600,000 per state.
Okay. So no thought went into, is it realistic to be able to do this job effectively, given the number of people that are trying to be addressed?
Well, actually, that's part of what an application would help to consider and would say to us, you know, in terms of what is the community or communities that you're proposing to serve, and what is your, you know, part of what you or, you know, the organization that you're with would submit would be a budget proposal and what you think it costs to assist that community or communities, and then it will be evaluated by an objective review committee once we receive it.
So are you suggesting there might be materially more funds available, you know, based on the applications you receive, or is this all there is?
Oh, no, I'm sorry if I implied that. No, the total amount of funding available is, as indicated in the funding opportunity announcement, up to $54 million. This is what we have to award.
Okay, and what if you don't get applications that add up to that number or less?
So I think that is also outlined in the FOA, and I, off the top of my head, I'm not sure exactly which page it's on, but there's essentially a second review, maybe not the right phrase, but if, for example, we received applications in a given state and they requested funds that didn't equal the total amount that was allocated, the additional funds left over could be reallocated to other high-scoring applicants in other states. And that
you're answering the question the wrong way. What if the sum of the lowest bids in every state that meets your requirements added up to $150 million instead of $50
million? Oh, well, so it's taken on an application-by-application basis, and there's something that is called budget negotiations. That's part of the grant process and led by some of our colleagues in another division of CMS. And so they'll be working with each of the applications as we go through that process.
Okay. So there's a process after the fact. If the sum of the lowest bids exceeds your total funding, then you need to whittle it down to the total funding. Is that right?
Well, and it's not just if the numbers don't match up. I mean, it's what the project, it's, you know, detailed by
what an applicant proposes to serve. Yes, I understand. But if the sum of the lowest requests or the lowest proposals materially exceeds the total funding you have, something's got to give. I'm wondering whether there's any give on your side, or if all the give has to happen on the grant requester's side.
Well, so, you know, we're required to put in the FOA the total amount of funding that's available, and we've done so. So unfortunately, I think we just have to leave it at that. We have $54 million, and that's what we have to give.
Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Daryl Duvo. Your line is open.
Okay. Hi. Once you've awarded the cooperative agreements, inevitably during the time period, some of the entities will go out of business, decide that for whatever reason they can't continue function as a navigator entity. So I'm wondering, what would be the plan for filling in those holes? Might you take existing navigators and ask them to fill in the holes, or would you do some sort of a recompete, or how might that work?
So honestly, that is a question that we will need to take on a case-by-case basis, and probably a number of things will be determined in it, but that's not a process that we will be outlining on this call.
Okay, so then if I could just add one follow-up. So then since it's a case-by-case basis, I guess what I was trying to anticipate is if we put in the cooperative agreement and we're going to serve a certain region, let's just call it Atlanta, and then for some reason we could service another region, but we don't put that in there. But if somebody drops out in that region, mm-hmm. we would just want to make sure that we might be able to be considered. So
That's helpful information to know as we're working through the processes that we work through on this end, just that not just you in particular, that any potential applicant could be
right.
able or willing to serve in other areas should they be needed. That's a good reminder
right.
for us, too. Thank you.
Okay, fine. That's it, then.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Joseph Bernheim. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much. I have a question about training. My understanding is that there's going to be a single nationwide training module online, that won't be state-specific. Yet a number of the navigator functions really require a lot of state-specific information. What's your plan to supplement the training with state-specific information?
So first, just a general statement I forgot to make at the beginning. If folks, whenever they're asking questions, could limit them to two, we would greatly appreciate it. We know that we have a lot of questions coming in, so we want to get as many answered as possible. But then, sir, to answer your question, so the training will be, it won't be state-specific, but it will cover all of the functions that navigators are expected to perform. In terms of tailoring it to a specific state or area, that's where, that's why it's important for applicants in their applications to detail, you know, how well they know their area and how they best see serving their community, because one of our goals in choosing applicants is to have people that know their community and know how to, I guess, reach the people in their area so that they don't need training on that. They need training on how to help folks get enrolled in the marketplace. Oh, and I'll also add that we have some states that are in state partnership marketplaces, and they are creating state-specific training to help supplement in terms of their own Medicaid processes.
Your next question comes from the line of Courtney Hudson. Your line is open.
Thank you. FOA is fairly silent on the software and the infrastructure that's going to be provided by CCIIO for the Navigator service. So my first question is, can you provide more detail on what software is going to be provided and what the functionality will be of that for the Navigator program? How much software and how much functionality will it support in terms of the requirements of this grant?
So that is an internal process, an internal sort of business development, and that's something that we will coordinate and communicate with our grantees once they're awarded, if there's anything specific that they should need to know.
But I'm sorry, are you providing software or not providing software as part of this? I'm sorry, I don't really understand your answer.
I think you're going to have to explain what you mean by software. Do you mean... there is an exchange site where consumers will enroll into coverage and navigators will be assisting them through that process.
Okay, so I guess, so my question is specifically, for the functionality required to be provided for this grant, first you have eligibility determinations. So I'm assuming that, for example, the Plan Finder software that you have on healthcare.gov would be, the folks, successful awardees for this grant will be required to use that. Are there other modules or functionality that they will also be provided? I guess one, you just mentioned one for, is there a different module for actual enrollment that will be available to navigators?
So it will all be one system, but frankly, that's not, you know, the purpose of this call is to talk about the details involved with applying for a federal grant. So,
right. Well, then let me clarify. There's pretty heavy tech investment required to actually meet, or necessary to meet the requirements of this grant. So, do grantees have to explain how they're going to meet the software and data tracking requirements, or are those things that they're not expected to have to provide directly?
No, we haven't.
The grant is entirely silent on this.
We have. That's exactly right. That's because they don't have to provide us information on that front. If there's anything that we need to provide if there's anything that they will need, we will be providing it.
Okay. Can you create an FAQ for that? Because the grant is entirely silent on that. So for anybody who didn't already know that, that's fairly large expenditure and fairly important detail to leave out.
We'll consider it internally. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Natalie Carr. Your line is open.
Yes. I'm with Mid-Delta Community Consortium, and I was trying to figure out how I could intertwine my relationship with the Corporation of National Service and Community Services with the Navigator program, and was that possible?
I think that you would just need to apply under this FOA, either as your entity or as a consortium.
But we can't really answer the specific question as to whether the particular organizations that you're mentioning would be eligible or not eligible. You'd have to look through the FOA and determine that information based on what's outlined in the FOA.
I have a follow-up question to that. Basically, I guess we're wanting to know is it allowable to because sometimes you're told that you can't use federal funds to support another program that's granted through federal funds, and AmeriCorps is federal dollars. So can those two programs be used? Can they complement each other?
No, you can't. You're correct. You can't supplement other federal funds with these federal funds. They would need to be separate.
I think this is probably a question I need to call later on. I'm not wanting to supplement. We want to use our AmeriCorps members as navigators.
So I think you would need to detail how folks would only be reimbursed or paid through how their time would be allocated so that, let's say, 50% of time is spent doing the Navigator program and 50% of time is spent doing other functions of AmeriCorps or whatever the other projects are. If you can separate out duties so that folks are, being reimbursed or volunteering or whatever it is for their time, then you should be able to show that information. You just can't, double account for people.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa Pell. Your line is open.
Thank you. Can you clearly define for us what it means to facilitate selection of a QHP?
So this is, I'm sorry, it's kind of a very specific separation between facilitating and actually enrolling folks. So in terms of facilitating, it means the navigator will sit, next to a consumer and walk them through the process while the consumer is actually logged into their account and the consumer is the one inputting the information into the system, and then the system itself is in charge of enrolling, and the consumer is then in charge of finishing the process. So facilitate is kind of like assisting in this context.
So do we need to specify, or how will we know whether or not enrollment actually occurs?
So that's a very good question. It will be, it happens on, for lack of a better description, on the back end, and it will happen in connection with the issuer themselves. And so, you know, I suppose it's possible that it could happen quick enough to be in real time when a navigator is assisting them, but in other cases it may not happen until a later date or even until payment is made on the part of the consumer to the issuer. So we'll provide specific guidance in the training program that we're developing to help navigators understand how to move through this process.
So then we don't actually have to propose as a service target how many people that we will enroll. We just need to propose how many we will assist with enrollment.
I think that's right, and mostly because, you know, when a consumer comes to you, they may not be ready to enroll yet. They may just say, you know what, I think I need help setting up my account, or I have some questions about what this all means. And so you may be assisting a number of consumers who don't ultimately end up going through the enrollment process with your help. And you certainly would want to consider them as folks you're assisting.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Dottie O'Connell. Your line is open.
Thank you. Both of my questions were answered.
Great. Operator, can we have the next question?
Your next question comes from the line of Lewis Matthews. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is that we've been approached by a couple of different groups to be part of a consortium. We wouldn't be the lead applicant on either of them. We know we couldn't be eligible for more than one award, but could we conceivably be part of two applications?
Yeah, this is a great question, and we've also gotten this one a couple times. So in terms of you can apply on separate applications, but in doing so, I would just caution you that you should budget your time accordingly so that were both of them to be awarded, you would need to be prepared to carry out your duties or responsibilities at the same time in both.
Oh, so if both were awarded, we could be part of both of them? We wouldn't have to choose?
Yes, as long as you've budgeted and allocated your time. Like, you couldn't 100% work with either group.
Right. Okay. My second question is one that came up in listening to you describe what facilitating looks like. So I was under the impression that we wouldn't necessarily have to be physically located with the individual that we're helping navigate. I thought maybe we could do it over the phone or in some other format. Do we actually physically have to be sitting next to them in front of a computer to do this?
There's no requirement that you be physically present with the consumer, but there will be the Federal Call Center, and if you look through the FOA, there's a lot of points awarded for describing how you'll assist and work with consumers. So I would take that into account when describing, you know, the work that you'll be doing.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Lindsay Gloricio. Your line is open.
Thank you. Our first question is about the consumer application that was released today, and it shows on there that there's a section for authorized representatives and then a separate section right below it for application counselors and navigators. So our question is, could a navigator also serve as an authorized representative for a consumer?
I'm sorry, I can't speak to that application. It's a different program than this one.
Okay. So you don't have any guidance on whether a navigator could actually be an authorized representative in filling out the enrollment application?
That's still something that we're working through at this time, but we would definitely let grantees know as part of the training and the award.
Okay, thank you. And then my second question is kind of a follow-up to one of the previous callers' questions about facilitating selection versus actually completing enrollment for the consumer. So if there's a situation where the consumer is illiterate or they have language difficulties that might make it challenging for them to actually complete the application on their own, what's kind of the delineation there for a navigator as far as assisting versus actually completing the application on someone's behalf?
Sure. This is something that will also be covered in the training that we're still finalizing and working through.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Linda Walling. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. My question is whether a national nonprofit can apply on behalf of a consortium of state groups.
Sure. As long as, you know, everyone's eligible and you're also going to be performing the navigator duties in some capacity.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Hysteria Miller. Your line is open.
Hello, I'm in Texas, and my question is regarding the LEAD organization. And I wanted to know, and I think you may have answered this, but if the LEAD organization, and say the corporate office is in California, but the work is being done in Texas, but the LEAD organization is the 501c3. Is that allowable? Are we able to do that? Would the LEAD organization have to be functioning with those navigator duties, or can we do that?
So the LEAD organization would also have to perform the navigator duties in Texas in some capacity, but as long as that was covered, then it would be the LEAD organization wouldn't need to be physically present in Texas.
Okay. And so, but that is an okay setup, right? If they, you know, if the LEAD organization is in another state and we're actually, the funds will be, the navigators will be in Texas, that's okay. As long as the LEAD organization is functioning as a navigator,
I can't specifically sign off yes or no, but it sounds like it would work.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Suma Broma. Your line is open.
Hi, I have questions which is two-part. Can the insurers, the carriers, become navigators, apply for navigators, who are participating in the marketplaces?
Did you say health insurance carriers?
Companies, yeah.
No, that's one of the ineligible
Okay. groups. And the second note is... our member services or the customer services would be receiving calls starting October the 1st with regard to the marketplace's enrollment, right? So do they have to get trained similar to navigators?
Are you talking about a carrier's call center?
Yes, yes.
I'm sorry, we're not able to answer those questions on this call. This is specific to the navigator grants. And so
how do we get answers to those questions?
I would encourage you to reach out to, if you have other contacts within CSIO, that you could reach out to them and they can direct you to the right place.
Is there any specific email address I need to send my question to?
You can send it to the Navigator Grants email, and we can try and facilitate getting it to the right place.
Thank you so much.
Your next question comes from the line of Amanda Stangus. Your line is open.
Hi. I have a couple of quick questions. I think one of them is around the budgeting. I know that we're not doing a per-person budget allocation for this, but are we right to assume that in terms of making the case for the scope and breadth of our application that we're looking at all uninsured that we currently reach, or is it just the exchange eligible uninsured?
It's all the uninsured and underinsured and anyone that you are proposing to serve as a navigator grantee.
Okay, so we don't need to try to split out the specifics on who our exchange eligible population might be.
No.
Okay, thank you. And then another question, but I think this might be more about, this probably will come through later in the awardee training, but we are intending to apply as part of a collaborative or consortium of agencies and coming in as lead agency. And folks are starting to ask us about reporting requirements. I know that reporting is designated in the FOA as quarterly, but is there any more information about how the quarterly reports will be, what type of information they will require, or getting back to the question that came up earlier about the software program, will information be pulled out of that for the quarterly reports?
So there's some information on reporting in the PRA package that you can find online that's associated with the Navigator FOA, and it can help clear up some of those questions, but we'll definitely be providing more details on specific reporting formats and everything as part of the training and award information.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Vicki Kimbrell. Your line is open.
Hi. I wanted to ask if we would be able to apply as an independent applicant, and then also as part of a consortium?
Yes. As an independent applicant, you would need to make sure that you had an EIN or I think it's TIN number. It's like a tax identification number to be able to get registered. But similar to the woman that asked if she could apply as part of two consortiums, you would just need to budget your time accordingly, both in the individual application and the consortium application, to be prepared to work on both at the same time should both awards be made.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Bernice Mabry. Your line is open.
Hi there. My question is regarding the letter of intent. Do you have any specific rules? I've kind of scoured to find out if you have any specific rules for what should go in the letter of intent, like regarding partnerships or anything like that, or?
Sure. All the information is on page 16 of the FOA. There's a section entitled letter of intent that'll tell you everything you need to include.
Okay. And I noticed that you said that it is being registered as a cooperative agreement, and you said it's like a grant, but in SAM, should I be registered as a bid, as a federal bid, or as under a grant?
Judy, can you maybe help with this question?
Sure. You want to know where to register?
In SAM, there's a section that asks if I'm registering and as a federal bid or under a grant. And since
under
there was
a grant.
Okay. Thank you.
I think they're asked that question. I think federal bid may refer to contracts.
Refers to a contract. So then we would select grant.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from the line of Andrea Stevenson. Your line is open.
Hello. My question had to do with, in terms of setting goals for the deliverables of the potential people that we will assist with enrollment, if it initially we set a goal or a benchmark and we find that either the response is overwhelming or we're having lack of a response, is there a renegotiation period within the one-year time frame?
Well, this is one of the benefits of a cooperative agreement is we'll be in very close contact with all of the grantees and talking on at least a monthly basis, if not more so. And there'll definitely be opportunities to restructure your budget or your work plan if you find out that things are changing extremely from what you had initially proposed or predicted.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Jennifer Seifrey. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is whether there's going to be some sort of federal media buy or PSA to kind of keep us from having to worry about those kind of expenses.
So there is a federal federal in terms of CMS leading outreach and marketing program in the federally facilitated and partnership states. That's led by another. It's not by our group. It's by another another area within CMS. We do expect Navigator grantees to do outreach and education, and particularly outreach and education to the community and communities that they propose to serve. And so, if someone was proposing to serve an entire state or a good portion of an entire state, then they should be prepared to do outreach and education in those particular areas.
Okay, great. Thanks. And my second question, if you don't mind, the training that you're planning to have, I know you've mentioned that it's not just broadly open to just annual agencies, but if we have a consortium and some partners, I mean, the funding can only go so far, and there are some staff within organizations that are funded, and even some consortium partners that are not entirely funded but are, you know, partnering, will this training be open to all staff they would like to put in as in-kind?
So, you know, the intention is that the training will be available to anybody who, any staff who are receiving, who are funded or coordinating with the Navigator program. I think that your particular question may get a little deeper than that. It sounds like maybe you're proposing some volunteer work or maybe some stakeholder group involvement that may not be directly associated with receiving grant funds. So it's hard to answer that question without more specifics, and I think we'd probably be able to give you more information should your application be awarded.
Well, if you don't mind my giving you an example, if you have staff who are doing assistance for families with NJ Family Care or within a hospital who are helping families get on programs and they take on that one extra role with training, would they be allowed to attend the training?
I think I'm confused. I think I'm confused. Are you saying like people who have certain positions and then they're taking on the role of a navigator in addition or for a portion
right.
of their role?
Because
yeah,
they're already serving families.
They would be required to take the training.
Oh, great.
If they're performing the duties of a navigator, they're required to take the training.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Eric Kennel. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first is regarding indirect rates. Our organization has received federal grants in the past, and we have a negotiated indirect rate that has now expired. Should we submit a budget using that previous rate, or how would you suggest that we include those in our application?
So on page 33 of the FOA, there's some information about this, but basically if your rate agreement is expired, you'll need to get a new one in place before you can request a higher rate or a different rate.
So we would submit a proposal at the time of this application, I assume?
That I'm not sure about, but if you refer to page 33, there's a website that can better answer that question.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't directly answering the question of what to do if you have an expired rate, so that's what we're trying to get information about.
I'll also encourage you to email. Unfortunately, our colleagues from that handled this portion of the grant couldn't be on the phone, but On page 39 of Michelle Fagan's is listed as the administrative questions. And you can email her, and she can help clear that up.
Okay, thanks. Uh-huh. And my second question is, do you recommend that we include letters of support, and do they count towards the total 21-page limit?
They're completely optional. We're not encouraging or discouraging them. You can include them as part of the appendix, and it won't count against the page limit.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Josephine Mercado. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. I'm calling on behalf of a group that I'm trying to form here in Florida. One of the people looking at the application that was put online today asked whether or not that application is only for mailing, or is that the application we're actually going to be filling out online?
So it's my understanding that that is a paper application, but this isn't really part. I mean, it is part of this call, but it's not what we're focused on here.
You're not going to discuss the application then? Who would be discussing that, you know?
I'm honestly not sure. That's a different office.
Will the training be in English, or will they also include it in Spanish?
And you're talking about training for navigators themselves?
Yes.
It will definitely be in English. We are still working through whether it will be provided in Spanish. We are we're still working through some outstanding issues, but we should have that answer fairly soon.
Okay. And my third question, and thank you for putting up with me, will you consider two grassroots community organizations for the same state as qualifying as a consumer-focused nonprofit?
So the requirement that there be at least two types of entities does not mean that there can only be one of each type. So assuming, you know, all other things, you know, about the application are appropriate, and it's an eligible entity who applies, and they put forward a good application that's scored well by the objective review panel, there would be no reason to limit it only to one group.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Mark Mouton. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Several of the states have health insurance brokers associations already set up, and they make up, for example, in my state, about 350 licensed, registered health insurance brokers, many who have been in the business for 15, 20, 30 years. Are they going to be allowed to act as navigators?
So agents and brokers are certainly eligible to apply as navigators. The one requirement that we have made, and it's outlined, I don't know if you've seen it, but there was a notice of proposed rulemaking that was published a few weeks ago on the navigator program. And in previous guidance, we've talked about it as well, that agents and brokers who apply to be navigators cannot continue to receive consideration directly or indirectly from health insurance issuers. So an agent or broker couldn't be both acting as a navigator and selling insurance, health insurance to consumers. They could be, you know, for example, an agent or broker of property and casualty insurance or homeowners insurance and also serve as a navigator.
So in essence, the most qualified are not going to be able to do it. What about someone in the office of, let's just say we had a broker who had someone in his office who was not a licensed agent, but was like a service representative. Could that person qualify?
So I think I'd refer you back to the ineligible entities on page 13 of the FOA, and what it says is that recipients of any direct or indirect consideration from any health insurance issuer in connection with the enrollment of an individual or employees in a QHP or non-QHP would be ineligible.
Okay. Got it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Ray White. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you.
Hi. I have two questions here, and one is on the questions of duties of a navigator in terms of understanding the application process. Like I heard, say, on President Obama talking about originally the application is going to be 21 pages, but now they've gotten it down to 3. So when you have a person who's all ready to go, what is the process, and is it a paper form, is it electronic, or what's involved in that process? And then I have a second question.
So navigators will be trained on the appropriate processes before beginning to perform their duties. Generally speaking, I'll say that there is both the paper form that folks have been asking a few questions about on today's call. I will reiterate again that those of us here around this table answering these questions are not the folks who developed that application. So we don't have the expertise to provide you with an answer to that, and that's not the focus of this particular call today. There is also an online application that is different in terms of it's more interactive and will be available to consumers online.
Got it. Okay. The second question is there some FAQ that talks about what goes in a successful proposal? I mean, it sounds like from the people on the call, you're going to have all different size organizations from different fronts. I mean, what makes for scoring, you know, how do you better your application? I mean, you know, sounds like everyone seems to be pretty qualified, but how does your proposal stand out?
Sure. So if starting on page 28 of the FOA, there's the criteria and it actually says how many points are awarded to each section. So when you're crafting your application, I mean, you definitely want to take all of those factors in mind and speak to them as best as you can to try to achieve the highest score possible.
So there's no, like, sample proposal anywhere online?
No, this is I'm not sure if grants.gov has anything, but this is the first run for this FOA.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Herman Edwards. Your line is open.
Thank you. Hi, I just want clarification because I walked out from a training under Elaine Sally with Family US of A, and then I've been on other calls also. And I thought I understood from my call yesterday from Dr. Renard Murray and Dr. Pamela Rochelle that an applicant, when it comes to subcontracting, cannot come through two different coalitions. You have to select one. Now, I pretty much remember that, and I've been kind of going back through my notes, and I just need clarification on that because that's what I'm informing others of. If we can apply through two different coalitions for subcontracting, let me know.
So thank you for that question. I'm sorry if the information that you received on the call yesterday was different. The information that Gian had been sharing with a couple of other questioners this afternoon regarding being able to apply through more than one application is guidance that we have been given from our Office of Acquisitions and Grants Management, who sort of lead the grant policy development around all grants that are developed and awarded by CMS. So that is our understanding from our colleagues in with the grants management within CMS, and that's how we'll be looking at the applications that come in.
Okay.
Your next question comes from the line of Ingrid Barbary. Your line is open.
Hello. Hi. My question is whether or not the actual federal regulations
are going to restrict the navigator requirements that a state can enact.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question? We had a hard time hearing the end of it.
Sure. So do the actual federal regulations restrict in any way what the states can do in establishing their navigator requirements?
Oh, you mean like the standards for training and conflicts of interest and things like that?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You're talking specifically about state-based marketplaces?
Yeah.
So the state-based marketplaces, if you look at the Navigator NPRM that came out a couple of weeks ago, state-based marketplaces are encouraged to use the standards that we set forth for federally facilitated and partnership marketplaces, but they are not required to use the same standards that we've set forth, that we've proposed.
Is there a floor that they can't go under, or are there some things that they necessarily have to meet?
So they would have to meet the requirements of the regulations that have been set forth. I wish I could remember the exact date. They came out in spring of 2012, and they're outlined in 45 CFR, section 155.210. And, of course, in statute at 1311I of the Affordable Care Act.
Your next question comes from line Herman Touch. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for the meeting, first of all. But I'd like to say, Florida Blue, we have a position here that's the community educator for teaching people about healthcare reform. Now, the question I have, as a community educator, I am working for an insurance company, but at the same time, could I refer people so that they can touch base with these navigators, since I am coming from an insurance company, without any idea of making any kind of commissions or any kind of restitution or any kind of extra money off of that?
I don't think there's any reason why a consumer couldn't be connected with a navigator from other entities or groups.
Including the insurance company. Including the insurance company, correct?
Right. I mean, you're, as you indicated, you're ineligible from applying to receive a navigator cooperative agreement, but there is no limit or inability for you to refer any consumers you may be working with to a navigator that may exist in their community.
And the second question is, can I receive this navigator training to understand what they're doing on their end?
Unfortunately, this training is open specifically to navigator grantees and staff associated with the grant or with the cooperative agreement.
Is there any kind of like signing up for that, or can I just get it from one of those that are providing the service without registering?
It's not open to the public, so it wouldn't be something that folks could just find their way to or get from someone else. It's possible that there may be other opportunities where training may be available outside of the Navigator program. That's not something that's been worked through internally here at this point, but I guess I would encourage you to just to keep your eyes and ears open to see if there's any training opportunities in the future for, you know, other folks in the community who are interested in having the information.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jacob White. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. I think that the question has been answered in previous discussions, so I'll table that.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just say for the record, it had to do with your estimated numbers of the uninsured in the chart and the specific allocation that was earmarked to a state.
Mm-hmm.
And in that assessment, the question deals with numbers reached. And what would be a reasonable expectation when you look at a state number of potentially insured and you're trying to leverage what is proposed in the FOA with the number that theoretically needs to be reached? Does that make sense?
So you're talking about the number that like an applicant's proposing to serve and
Comparison to the total number of projected uninsured. So is there a formulary of any type that the review team is potentially looking at to say, based upon this whole conversation around outreach numbers reached, those assisted versus those that are actually enrolled, and those some of the factors that you discussed earlier, is there any kind of formularity that weighs or gives weight to how many proposed individuals are reached within the total population of uninsured?
No, there's no focus on that in the objective review committee. The only thing that they'll be looking at in terms of the weighting applications are the points received that begin on page 28 of the FOA for the different categories.
Okay, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Angela Lawson. Your line is open.
Hi. One question was answered, and this I don't know if you can answer. Is there anywhere where we can check to see if the demographic we're considering for our grant has been awarded prior grants?
No, unfortunately, all the applications awards are going to be announced at the same time.
Okay. And as an individual working with, I want to apply as an individual and as a lead for our nonprofit organization, and you said that was okay to do. I just had to get an EIN as an individual and then apply as a consortium, or is that what it would be?
Yes, both of those are correct. Also in the budgets for both your individual and your consortium application, you would need to separate out your time should both awards be made so that you're not 100% working with either group.
Okay, but there is the possibility that either one or the other could be awarded. And maybe not both.
Right. But when applying, our colleagues in the Office of Grants Management have asked that in order to apply on multiple applications that you be prepared for, you know, not the worst case, kind of the worst case scenario, and that both are awarded.
Okay. All right. And it's okay for one to be in one state and one to be in the other?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lori Zimmerman. Your line is open.
Hi. We're in Missouri. I'm wondering if there's a way we could find out if there's other folks in our area who might be interested in joining a consortium with us.
Unfortunately, we don't have access to that information. I would just encourage you to reach out to folks in your state and your community and kind of to talk around to some of the local nonprofits maybe and see if anybody is keeping track of that.
Okay. And second quick question, if we missed the letter of intent deadline, well, if we missed that, would it be worthwhile still to send something in a few days late?
Sure. It's a flexible, it's completely optional, but if you want to send a letter in afterwards, that's fine too.
Does that strengthen our application?
Honestly, it just helps us from a planning perspective, knowing how many to anticipate receiving, so we know how long the review process is going to take and everything.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Ricardo Salvella. Your line is open.
Thank you. I was calling because I wanted to just confirm a couple of things that I'm seeing as I'm reading the big document. If I'm reading it correctly, it's only a 1 year grant.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes.
Mhm. Okay, and then also I'm confirming also on page 27, it says you know, the funding cannot be used to cover the cost to provide direct health care services to individuals. That is, am I right in thinking that's more regarding the clients, not necessarily staff that would be, you know, the fringe for the staff?
Right. You can definitely provide insurance to your staff. That's right. You can't provide direct insurance to consumers.
Okay. And then I guess my next question is, if, you know, it comes down to our state, and if I'm right in thinking that, you know, if we apply as the, I know different people have been using the word lead, but if we apply as, I guess, the lead or physical agent, are we allowed to have subcontracts with agencies to be able to actually do, to provide services, you know, the majority of the services? I know you've stated, you know, the lead still has to do a portion of it, but if the majority of it was done through subcontractors, is that okay?
So it sounds like you're talking about a consortium, and if you, and that's certainly, you know, a consortium is certainly acceptable, but as Gian had mentioned earlier, all of the members of a consortium, including the lead applicant, have to be able to perform all of the required duties of the navigator. And so the sort of the differentiation among that is that there's no requirement that every group perform each of the required duties for the same percentage of time. So for example, one agency may be really good at doing outreach and education, and so you would probably expect that they might do more outreach and education efforts than some of the other groups, but everybody should still be performing all of the duties.
Okay. And then another question I had was, if I'm reading it correctly, it says the billing is quarterly. As far as turning in the, you know, the submission, and I'm trying to find out whether or not this is a strictly reimbursed grant, so that, you know, if an agency got it and they had it for, they provided their own funds for the first 3 months, and then they'd have to submit the paperwork to be able to get reimbursed for that. Am I right in thinking that?
No. So the reporting is quarterly. And then beginning on page 33 under the terms and conditions section, it discusses how once awards are made, accounts will be established and all of the grant funds will be placed into that account, and then you can draw down on an as-needed basis.
Okay, so it's not a reimbursement grant. It's
no.
Okay, so the funds would be there if we got awarded.
Yes.
And it would just be, you know, expensed, you know, on a monthly basis, pretty much.
However you
use
them.
As you use them.
And, you know, the reporting requirements help to account for what the funds are used for, and then, of course, as a cooperative agreement, we would be coordinating and communicating with each of the grantees to ensure that funds were used in an appropriate manner and in accordance with the project plans that are outlined in each of the applications.
Okay, that was my questions. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jorge Gomez. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is the first time that I'm learning about the whole process, so I'm trying to understand how this is going to work, and please correct me if I'm wrong. There's going to be a marketplace that is basically going to be a pool of private insurance and state sponsor insurance. So the function of the navigator is going to be help individuals in the community to apply for those health insurance. Am I correct on that?
I think you're pretty close. So there will be a marketplace in every state, and the this FOA is for individuals or entities in the federally facilitated marketplace states and the and the partnership marketplace states, and on who those states are all listed in the FOA. But the navigators will help consumers who come to them with questions go through the process, essentially the eligibility and enrollment process. And it may turn out that a consumer is eligible for what's being called a qualified health plan through the marketplace. And so the navigator would assist the consumer in the ways that they need as they're going through that process. It may also be determined through the initial application process that someone or perhaps a portion of a family is eligible for public programs like Medicaid or the CHIP program. And so in that instance, the navigator would help get folks over to the correct program in their state, whether it's Medicaid or CHIP or other things like that.
Okay. The second part of my question, are we allowed to serve undocumented individuals in the community, given that some of them might be able to afford, the insurance that are not operated by the state?
So undocumented individuals are not eligible for qualified health plan coverage through the marketplaces.
Okay. And the final question that I have, as a nonprofit agency, we don't necessarily need to be part of a consortium to apply for the grant, right? We can do it on our own.
That's correct. You don't have to be part of a consortium.
Okay, got it. All right, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Naomi Cotton. Your line is open.
Both my questions have been answered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Kathleen Holmes. Your line is open.
I'm brand new to my position here and just got thrown on this call, so please excuse my ignorance. I work for Legal Aid, and we have attorneys at different hospitals that help people get insurance and with their problems with the Medicaid and Medicare. Is this a grant that we would be eligible for?
As long as you're proposing to perform all five duties that are listed in the FOA, and nobody is an ineligible entity, then it should be.
And okay, one other question. So, eligible candidates are all uninsured and underinsured, because I had heard something about they had to be over 100% of poverty.
You mean to be assisted by a navigator?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your next question comes from the line of Tom Ruperta. Your line is open.
Yes. My question deals with ineligible groups. If someone is a licensed insurance agent and has a health license, if they serve as a navigator, am I to understand that that person then can no longer sell long-term care insurance or disability, because both of those are health products?
So that's a very good question, and that's not – I don't believe that's something that we've outlined in our proposed regulations at this point. I would encourage you to submit that question to Navigator Grants at cms.hhs.gov, and we can try and put that into one of our FAQs that go out to get some additional clarification around that.
All right. Can you repeat that, please?
Sure. The email address?
Yes.
It's Navigator Grants with an S on the end, navigatorgrants@cms.hhs.gov.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Erica Wicks. Your line is open.
Hi. My question's already been answered.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. And to remove your question from the queue, please press the pound key. Your next question comes from the line of Maria Teresa DeCespi. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. Very quick question. I've understood that every consortium, the subcontractors, if that's what you're calling them, are they subgrantees or subcontractors? I'm not sure. Either way, okay. Then the question is, I've understood that each subcontractor, subgrantee would have to have a DUNS and SAMS number. Is that correct?
Judy, can you maybe get this one?
You know, that depends on the legislation, and that would actually be a question that you would ask. You mean the subcontractor, the subcontractors or awardees within the original award?
And within the consortium.
And you're going to subcontract some of that work or, there would be sub-awards made. Are you asking
yes.
if each one of the folks would need a DUNS?
A DUNS and SAMS.
Well, if they're not submitting a grant application in grants.gov, there's no reason for them to need a SAM registration, as far as I know, or DUNS for that matter. But I really can't answer that. I can only tell you what the applicant would need to have when they submit their application in grants.gov.
So,
right. so if you're the organization or the individual that is submitting the application. Well, the organization, individuals don't need DUNS numbers, but the organization, you would need a DUNS, and you would need to be registered with SAM, have an active registration with SAM, and be registered in grants.gov. And
right.
can I
no,
say
I've got
those to be remaining on the line to please register now if you haven't already?
Yeah, we've got the DUNS, the SAMs, and the AOR. Registration.
Good.
The question came because that we were told that each subcontractor / subgrantee within the consortium underneath the lead agency also had to have these numbers.
Who told you that?
On another one of the calls.
That would actually be a question that would have to be answered by CMS, by the
okay.
Program. That's providing the funding.
Okay. I'll go ahead and send that via email. The
ma'am?
Next one.
No, ma'am. Sorry. We actually found the answer. It's on page 15 of the FOA, and it says that primary awardees must maintain a current registration with SAMS and with the SAM database, and they can only make subawards or subcontracts to entities that have a DUNS number.
Thank you very much. Okay, perfect. Okay, then my next question is very simple. I already heard that if you are adding on navigator duties to someone that's already having some sort of eligibility, that by default, I would assume that people can be cross-trained. We're looking at three different kinds of training. There is a one eApp. It's a common eligibility tool that we're looking to launch in our area. Then there's obviously the federal marketplace. And then we also, in Florida, there's the DCF eligibility coordinators. So potentially every federal navigator would have to be cross-trained in all three in our area. And that would be okay.
There's no federal requirement that navigators who will be awarded grants in your state must take additional training. I'm not familiar with
right.
the two programs that you just mentioned.
Right. No, I understand that. But I'm saying if someone's already trained in this, there's no restriction on them being trained and having like a dual role as a federal navigator and these other kinds of roles that they would have.
as long as their time and their time is allocated appropriately in your application. So you couldn't fund 100% of somebody's salary to only spend 50% of their time being a navigator.
Absolutely. Fantastic. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of David Mortimer. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions, and my first question has to do with page 10 on the FOA. It notes that the overall funding available may increase if all funds are not expended in Tier 1 review, and that makes me think if Texas, that's being apportioned $8.1 million, doesn't use all of their funds in Tier 1, could some of those funds be reappropriated in a Tier 2 for another state? And then I have a second question.
Yes, that's exactly what that means. After the first tier of review, if there's any, you know, as after we've gone through all the eligible and qualified applications for each state and made sure that at least two entities, one of which is a consumer or community-focused nonprofit, have been awarded, if there's still funds left over, then we're going to pool all of those together and award remaining eligible and qualified applications based on the factors listed on page 12.
Thank you. And then my second question has to do, I have eight nonprofit hospitals, eligible nonprofits in central and southern Illinois in high concentration areas of uninsured folks. And I was wondering, we're having a difficult time in identifying a lead organization that would like to do this. And does CMS or CIIO offer any help in communicating with other organizations, or will the LOIs be listed online so that we could see what other organizations are putting together an application so that we could, you know, put together a more geographically comprehensive application?
Unfortunately, we can't share the letters of intent at this time, and we don't have a list of who all is applying or planning to apply even in the various states. I just encourage you to reach out to folks that you may know around the state and try to find out if you can, you know, find other groups in the state that are also looking to apply or considering applying.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Operator, at this time, it looks like we're almost at 5 o'clock. How many questions do we have left?
At this time, we still have another 60 participants in queue for questions.
I guess we'll try to handle we'll take 5 more questions, and then I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut the call off.
Your next question comes from the line of Rick Alvarez. Your line is open.
Yes, I have a question in relationship to the point system that you have for scoring the application. It says staff experience, private health insurance market. And what kind of expertise or what kind of level are you looking there? Because we're well versed in the typical stuff, but of course we won't be as well versed, for example, as an insurance agent. So
right.
What span are you looking there?
You know, that's definitely understandable. We can't comment specifically about the criteria in that much detail, but we just encourage applicants to speak to their skill set and their abilities as best as possible.
Okay. And then the next question, just very briefly, is on the 30 hours of training, is that going to be internet-based, or how is that training be accomplished?
Yes, it'll be available online on an ongoing basis after award announcements are made for grantees.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Marilyn Ruiz. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. I'm just wondering, for the when writing our application, it does have description for the 21 pages maximum for the 15 pages for narrative, but there's no mention of supporting documentation such as letters of support, logic models, job descriptions or resumes. Are these documents necessary, and what would we be using to support staff credentials?
Sure. So all of those documents are they're optional, but you know, as you mentioned, supporting staff credentials, if you wanted to include a resume, you are free to use the appendix or attachment option, and there's no page limit restriction on that.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I think that answers mine.
Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Hong Liu. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One question is that does the navigator have to be full-time or can be part-time?
They can be either.
Can be either, okay. The other question is that can, for example, if my agency join a consortium and I receive, for example, $50,000, can I subcontract the $50,000 part of $50,000 to a different member to do the work?
As the lead applicant, you would also need to be able to perform all five duties as well.
Yeah, but can I subcontract to another organization who of course is qualified to perform the duties, but they were not originally included in the proposal?
You can subcontract some of the work, but you would also need to be doing some as well.
Yeah, but it's okay for my agency to do part of the, to perform all the duties, as well as I can subcontract some money to a different agency to perform all the duties.
Yes, that's, as long as they're not one of the ineligible groups.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Your next question comes from the line of Kelly Persons. Your line is open.
Great. Thank you. I do have two questions, and hopefully they'll be quick, and I do apologize if this had already been answered. The first question on the letter of intent, I know it is due tomorrow. Is that close of business tomorrow or midnight tomorrow? Kind of the time frame on that. And the second question, I'll go ahead and just blurt it out there. The DUN number, and I'm sorry, I heard a reference earlier, but I didn't quite catch it all. We're a state branch of a national organization. Can we use our national organization's DUN number, or do we need to apply for our own?
So with regard to the letter of intent, there's no time deadline on that, just anytime tomorrow.
Okay.
Judy, I don't know if you can speak to the DUNS question.
Who's submitting the application?
It would be our state branch would be submitting it.
So your state would be submitting it, your state office of what have you, whatever.
Correct.
Public health. You would use their DUNS.
Okay.
You know, you're going to use, whoever's receiving the money, that's the DUNS number that you would your organization or that organization would be registered under. Now, if you're the one that's actually going to be submitting the application, you'll need to make sure that you know who the e-business point of contact is who is registered for that DUNS number in the System for Award Management or SAM.
Okay.
And you would also be, using you as an example as the applicant, you'd also need to be registered as an applicant and authorized permissions to submit in grants.gov.
So, Judy, this is CSIO. Can I ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
Was your response that the state affiliate organization could use the national organization's DUNS number as long as they have the appropriate agreement or connections in the SAM system, or is it that if the local agency or the state agency is the applicant, that they have to get their own DUNS number?
If they're the applicant, they need their own DUNS. Whoever's applying for the funding and receiving the funding, that organization needs to have a DUNS number.
Thank you.
And thank you for clarifying. Thank you.
And your last question comes from the line of Kathleen McLaughlin. Your line is open.
Thank
Thank you. I just had a question regarding if a consortium is applying under this funding opportunity, will additional pages be allowed based on the number of states that they expect to serve?
So as a consortium, you do need to have separate budget narratives, so you can have up to 3 pages for each state. But all the other page limit requirements are the same, but you can submit any additional information in an appendix and reference that in the application.
Okay, and in terms of the format of the appendix, do we need to submit it in a PDF format, or are there restrictions in terms of that?
I believe the whole application needs to be in a PDF format.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, your attachments would be in a PDF format, or actually, it could be PDF or it could be Word if there are attachments required with this application. But yes, the entire application is submitted as one file, as a PDF file. You need to also make sure that you have the Adobe software in order to download the application package and to submit it, and you can get that free from Adobe. And we have an Adobe compatibility chart on our website if you're not sure which version you need to download and submit the application on grants.gov.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we are going to end our call. I thank you all for joining us today, and I hope that we got to answer as many questions as possible, and I hope that this was helpful for you all as you're working on these applications. I encourage you to continue to check our website for resources and updating FAQs as they become available. At this time, I will let you all go, and operator, you can end the call.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.